This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and on this show, we talk to celebrities, authors, mindfulness experts, visionaries, and thought leaders who've devoted their lives to their calling, their purpose, to finding and following their bliss or their soul's work on this planet, as it were. And often they're so passionate about something that the world needs that only they can offer. And they're so driven to do this work that it becomes a lifelong mission for them. As such, I'm especially fascinated by people who devote their entire lives to studying a subject, or in some cases, a person, that they find deeply compelling and meaningful. From the time she was a little girl, award-winning documentary filmmaker, Canadian video journalist, former CBC investigative reporter, and now author, Roxana Spicer, was deeply fascinated, some might even say in awe, of her mother, Agnes, and her mother's story. In Roxana Spicer's masterful book, The Traitor's Daughter, captured by the Nazis, pursued by the KGB, My Mother's Odyssey to Freedom from Her Secret Past, she spends much of her life discovering what her mother would never talk about, her life during World War II. And for over 30 years, Roxana untangles these wartime secrets by doing meticulous and exhaustive research, archival research, multiple interviews with historians, eyewitnesses, experts, and even her own family members, including 12 trips to Russia and 3 to Germany, among many other locales, including Auschwitz and Poland. What Roxana discovered was that her Russian-born mother, Agnes Rosa Nikolavina Butorina Spicer, was a Red Army soldier in the Second World War, that she was captured by the Nazis and was in fact a Nazi slave, and that she was also a prisoner at Ravensbrück and Auschwitz. She endured 2 years as a slave laborer in Germany while being hunted by the KGB, and under brutal Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, all Soviet POWs were classified as traitors during and after the war. And what has to be noted here is that all of this happened before Agnes's 24th birthday. She was only 23 years old. Much of this deeper research had to be conducted after Agnes's death in 2009 and after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. After then, finally, Roxana was able to get access to people, documents, and research that had been hidden away for decades. What's so amazing is that this all started much earlier. Since the age of 10, Roxana began documenting fragmented pieces of her mother's past, which had been sparingly revealed to her in the midnight hours in their home in rural Saskatchewan. I want to congratulate you, Roxana. First of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
On this tour de force, your book, The Traitor's Daughter, became a national bestseller when it was first published last year, 2024, and now the paperback version has just been released on August 26, 2025 by Penguin Random House Canada. Roxana, it's an honor to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. And thank you so much for that wonderful introduction.
I not only read your book, but I also listened to it on Audible, which I highly recommend to everyone. It's a wonderful way to experience it. I loved this memoir and how you weave together your personal story, your mother's story, this history into the Second World War, the past, the present, into this odyssey. I cried a lot. Oh. I cried even in the acknowledgements in that paragraph that you wrote about your mother. I don't know if that was a conscious decision, but it was purposeful to really create a lot of pathos there, but it did. And I was fascinated by your mother, by you, and by this whole other life that your mother left behind and got to re-experience 50 years later. So what a huge accomplishment. So again, congratulations on all of this. This labor of love, I would say. You've said the book is a result of a decades-long quest to understand your extraordinary mother, who was born in Lenin's Soviet Union, served as a combat soldier in the Red Army, as just mentioned, and endured 3 years of Nazi captivity, but never revealed her darkest secrets. And I was captivated by the fact that as a child, you would sometimes wake up at midnight to the sounds of the Red Army Choir, and you would tiptoe downstairs to find your mother, cigarette in hand and Black Russian in the other, singing along, and you would keep her company and wonder. So I just want to play a clip for our listeners right now from your audible version of The Traitor's Daughter to set up your story. So everyone, the voice that you're hearing, the narration is by Roxana Spicer, and it's excellent. Let's all have a listen.
The siren call of the Red Army Choir lures me out of my warm bed, down to where Mom sits alone, legs tucked under her, in her favorite velvety green chair that Dad got for her at yet another Prairie Farm auction. She stirs her vodka and Kahlua on ice with an index finger. I take my place at the far end of a matching forest green couch, barefoot and quiet in my flannel pajamas. Between the clinking ice cubes and the scratchy Soviet music, Mom cracked open her personal iron curtain and let me in. She lobbed words into mid-air, letting them float there, alongside blue cigarette smoke swirling from a circular black glass ashtray nested on a decorative metal pillar near her arm. I understood the words. Unlike her singing, they were in English. But the meaning would take me almost a lifetime to figure out.
Wow. What's it like for you to hear that back? The writing is exquisite.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it's a kind of an out-of-body experience, actually, to hear that again, because as contradictory as it may sound, I didn't actually go back and listen to the audiobook after we recorded it. It puts me back in the middle of the Cold War, in that little house on the beside the highway, the number 7 highway in Saskatchewan. And once again, you know, I can hear the truckers going by at midnight, and I can hear the ice cubes clinking in my mother's glass again. And yeah, it puts me right back into, well, there's two things that are going on. It puts me back there as a little girl, but also it reminds me of how many drafts it took to get that right. You know, there was a tremendous amount of writing and rewriting, you know, to really strike the right chord. And I tried to do that throughout the whole book. My intention was to be really conscious not to use language in any way that was exploitive or sensational. I really wanted to write a truthful book, a book that was truthful, not only in the facts, but in the tone. So that's a bit of a long answer. It's quite a kaleidoscopic experience to hear my own voice again, but I think it still captures that moment.
You know, when I was experiencing the book, I kept seeing it as a feature film. And I know you have plans in the work for a documentary, which it, of course, lends itself to as well. But are there any plans in the work for feature films? I don't know why. I just imagined myself sitting in a darkened theater.
Oh, I love that. I can hardly wait for you to be sitting in that darkened theater. And I hope I'm sitting beside you when the opening credits come up. Last year, during the Toronto International Film Festival, I did have a 3-hour meeting with one of the leading production companies in Canada, and the executive producer and the potential screenwriter met with me and took the book, and they are currently reviewing it. And wow. I'm hoping that we're going to be able to move forward on something. So I'm hopeful, but the more immediate prospect of doing a feature-length documentary is probably going to be the first next iteration of the book. Fingers crossed on that too.
Wow. I wish you the best of luck with all of it. I really, really do.
Thank you, Judy.
So as you've just sort of mentioned, you grew up in Netherhill, Saskatchewan, population 80. And as a documentary filmmaker and former CBC investigative journalist, your award-winning work across Canada led to real change. You pursued stories in Ecuador. You traveled to the Arabian Desert, the North Sea. You've reported from a high-tech ocean dive ship, a nomadic Kyrgyz yurt, and made multiple trips to Russia during the Wild West years during the fall of the Soviet Union. What you excel at is asking questions, but by far your most elusive interview subject over your 40-year career has been your own mother. Can you tell me more about those midnight times where your mother sat with her legs tucked under her, she's drinking those Black Russians and smoking cigarettes? What was it like to be that little girl sitting on the couch and just listening spellbound to your mother? Were you almost like, I almost got the sense that you were holding your breath.
Yeah, it seems very contradictory, but I knew intuitively as a little kid that if I was going to actually learn anything about my mother's past, the secret to doing that would be to sit still, to listen, to just be available for whatever might come out of her mouth, triggered by this combination of vodka on ice and the music. And I would actually see her disappearing into another world as she would listen to the music and take a couple more drags off her cigarette. That was an incredible training ground for me, as it turned out for my career later as a journalist, the ability to sit still and just to be patient. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, if at any point I had broken the spell by saying, well, what happened next, Mom? Or, oh my God, how did you live? You know, if I had any kind of emotive reaction, if it looked like I was engaged on that level, it would have spoiled the bubble. Yes. But I learned that if you sit still and just your receptacle, you're just there to listen, you'll get something, you'll absorb something. And then as soon as the session, I can call it that, a session, wow, the midnight session was over, and that could be an hour, could be 2 hours, I would run upstairs to my little bedroom, close the door, and jot down whatever I could remember. So, wow. And I'm so glad that I did that. That led to my first writing experience of putting together an essay when I think I was in grade 6. And this was the first time I presented my mother's story to a public, which happened to be in a darkened high school auditorium in Cold War, Saskatchewan. And I'm sure it was a packed crowd and my heart was beating faster than a gerbil. And then when I started to talk about my mother, the Red Army soldier captured by the Nazis, suddenly the whole room went quiet. And it was at that moment that I really got my first visceral sense of the power of storytelling, the ability to hold an audience, and what a privilege it is to be able to do that. Now, I was a little disappointed to confess that I only won second prize at that contest. It was an essay contest, but it was still one of the most formative experiences of my, shall we say, my early journalistic career.
Your father attended.
Yes, he did.
And I just sort of pictured him like very tall and almost ramrod straight and listening with great intent, but your mother didn't come.
Correct. Yeah, she didn't come. And I remember that. And I remember being confused by that. But my dad, you know, he was always the emotional rock of Gibraltar in the family, including for us three children, but especially for my mother. And he was just always such a great shoulder to lean on and very, very supportive. So I knew he was out there in the audience. And then he surprised me on the drive back, that long drive along the number 7 highway back to our little house on the highway. He didn't say anything. He wasn't like, and it was like, ooh, I knew I had done something. I had stirred something up. Yes. What was I telling him something that he didn't know? Did he realize that I was actually breaking some kind of unspoken code of silence in the family? It was it was an introduction to the reality that if you undertake this business of writing memoir, which can be very gratifying, it's a minefield.
Wow. It's this book, Roxana, has been a lifelong passion project for you. Can I ask you what drove you so relentlessly for 7 years to write and create this book? Because I'm sure there must have been some very difficult aspects. I don't just mean the research, the exhaustive, meticulous research, but just the emotion of it all.
Correct. That's a very intuitive question, Judy. Of course, anybody who has written a book or even written an essay or written a short story or perhaps even written a letter with an anecdote in it knows that when you sit down, the act of writing puts you back into that situation. So to write the book was to live it. And for me, there were many hard realities that I was writing about, particularly in the Nazi camps. That doesn't mean the entire book is heavy. It's up and down. There are some moments of real joy and real kindness and real surprises from corners of the world that I hadn't expected. But it was definitely a very all-engaging kind of experience. But I'd like to answer your question in this way, if I could. People ask me, you know, they say, as you have in slightly different words, like, how did you do it? How could you sit still for 7 years to write this book, not to mention the research that led up to it? And what drove you? And this is a kind of a paradox, but I think some of the best writing in the book is not mine, but actually the words that belong to my twin brother,
Victor.
Right. Who wrote to me on the occasion of our mother's death shortly thereafter. And for the first time, he shared his thoughts and articulated what it meant to have been raised by this silent mother. I'm going to just read that. It's about a minute. And I've got it right here. And this is actually one of the most, I think, one of the most powerful sections of the book. I'm just going to jump right in.
I'd love it.
Thank you. I begin with my own words. After Mum died, Victor wrote me with an eloquence I had not expected from my twin brother, who once said he felt like his tongue had been ripped out of his head. I have been to hell and back with emotions about Mum, her history, her losses, our losses. Not telling or knowing or remembering Mum's history is in a way like shutting another door to knowing her and the intimacy we never had.
Wow.
So my book is my effort to recover that intimacy, not just for me, but for my brothers and for a population of elderly people who still remember my mother. And also, I hope, in particular for young women, children, grandchildren, part of your listenership, because as you said in the introduction, these seminal events that happened to my mother, that really shaped her in so many ways, happened to her before her 24th birthday. And yet she found the strength and character to endure what is almost impossible to imagine. Mm-hmm. But she did it. She did it with love, and she did it with courage, and she did it with humor. And so I think in many ways, she's a fantastic role model for young women today.
She was born on November 7th.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you believe in this stuff. She was a Scorpio.
She believed in.
Very, very secretive.
Okay.
Private.
Yep.
Passionate. Strong. Never show a sign of weakness kind of people.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, the November 7th, it was also the anniversary of the revolution, which is where my head goes immediately, the Russian Revolution. But I'll go with the astronomy section too.
So this was the seed, the start of it all. And everyone in the Saskatchewan village where you lived knew that your mother, Agnes Spicer, was Russian, that she'd been a captive of the Nazis. And that was all they knew because Agnes kept her secrets close. How she managed to escape Germany, what the tattoo on her arm meant, even her real name. And discovering the truth about your beloved, charismatic, charming, fascinating, feisty, fiery mother became your obsession. And yet, I also wondered about this, and you've talked about it, how you must have felt caught between being a journalist and being a daughter, right? The journalist wants to know all, but the daughter is respectful of her mother's privacy and boundaries. And this must have been a constant tug of war for you.
Absolutely, Judy. There are many different kinds of war represented in this book that I tackle. But the one constant war that starts almost from page one to page 420, I think it is this internal war between Roxana Spicer, the daughter, and Roxana Spicer, the journalist. And I decided that I would let the reader in on that struggle, that they would come with me to see how that all works out, if it works out, towards the very end of the book. The one thing when I was feeling the most, even now, sometimes reading some of the sections, I think, oh my God, you know, I mean, I was never intended to know that. I was never intended to know that. I was definitely never intended to write about that and to share that. This theme about this struggle, this theme about do we have the right as children to our parents' secrets really dogged me through the whole book. But then there is a resolution, I think. And this was a very spontaneous outburst from, well, not an outburst, but just an aside from my mother during the last interview that I did with her on her 86th birthday in Calgary, Alberta, when I had the family gathered and I did have a television crew there and I did ambush her with a crew. And I am a little bit embarrassed by that, but I'm so glad today I've got that footage.
That you've got that footage, yes.
But she said then, without my prompting, everyone has a right to know who their predecessors are.
Yes.
So I remind myself about that in my moments of self-doubt on that front.
She did say that. She gave you that pass. She gave you that, that okay.
You know, and I just want to say something, Judy. The thing that was really interesting about that, apart from the obvious, I wouldn't call it a blessing, or if it is a blessing, it's a small b blessing, but it was like, but what I want to say is that when you're writing a book, you know, every character has a beginning, middle, and an end. Like there has to be a narrative arc for all of the characters. So this was something that happened almost by surprise for me. And I think other writers might be able to relate to this, is when the character takes on her own life in the book. And it's almost like it's something you hadn't anticipated. But my mother, in the course of me pursuing the truth about her, she also went through a kind of metamorphosis. She also went through a thing where she started to recognize that I, her daughter, her only daughter, was never really going to be at peace until I put the final period to the final sentence in the final paragraph of her life story. And she gave me that blessing.
When she permission. She gave me that permission.
Yeah. Permission's a better word.
It's incredible. And I write also that you, throughout your career as a journalist and documentarian, you always went home to ask your mother more and more questions, often while filming, and you've just described one. And a lot of this footage became the short film Strangers in Graveyards. But there was a taboo subject, and that was the number tattoo on her left arm.
Right.
And that's when I really thought about this journalist versus daughter, that you just knew that was verboten. Like, that was not okay. That was her privacy, and you didn't go there. But finally, your brother found a Kodachrome slide of your mother with her arms bare, and you were able to utilize that photograph to confirm that she was imprisoned in Auschwitz. And yet, no matter how much exhaustive research you did, the one question that was left unanswered was how your mother was ever able to escape from Auschwitz. Don't answer that just yet. We're going to go on a short commercial break. When we come back, we'll hear more about Agnes Spicer's escape from Auschwitz. We'll be right back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
We are back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio. And just before the break, we were discussing Agnes Spicer's escape from Auschwitz. As we come back, I'd like to begin with a quote by Roxana Spicer from her book, The Traitor's Daughter. Even right in the book, I quote, "I'm done. There's nothing left. I did my best. It was dark outside. I stayed for 3 hours. I screened every name. 4 reels of microfiche. I did it for Mom. I did it for myself. Maybe it's for the best. In the end, she eluded my best journalistic efforts. Part of me is relieved. Mom's greatest secret still lies with her ashes in the roadside graveyard of a prairie ghost town." Huh.
Yeah, that's really powerful to hear that read back. Thank you for that, Judy, for picking up on that. Yeah, that, I mean, even journalistically, I've had, for example, producers in the film industry now saying, oh my God, you know, if you're going to do that film, are you going to deal with this? I mean, how did she escape from Auschwitz? Like, there were a handful in the course of the history of that notorious patch of land in Poland of people who actually escaped, less than 1,000. And I had that confirmed by the highest authority on escapes when I went to do the field research in Auschwitz in Poland, outside of several miles outside of Krakow. But ultimately, this question, the detail, the mechanics, how she got past that electrified barbed wire, how she got out of there and landed up not in Poland, but several 100 kilometers away in another country, in Germany, working in a farmer's pasture, riding a cow that she named Emma. How did she do that?
How did she do that?
And this is the one thing the head of the Auschwitz Research Department, the research archive, said. She escaped. There's no other way that she could have landed up in Germany. The how of it, this is a mystery. This is the difference between writing fiction and nonfiction. Yeah. If I were doing the fictionalized version, of course, there's license there. But I had already made a pact with myself that I wasn't going to do any speculation. And I did that for me. I did that for the memory of my mother. And I did it for my brothers. There's enough real life going on. I didn't want there to be any question of credibility on a single word in the book. It had to be truthful in fact and in tone.
I think what you're saying is maybe this part of her life was better left a mystery.
Precisely.
And that's it. Another fascinating part of the book and your mother's story is all the different identities and personas that she has, including her different names. And really, there's three different identities. She was born Rosa in Russia after Rosa Luxemburg, the Marxist of Polish Jewish descent, who became one of the most famous socialist figures in the 20th century. Her Christian name was Agne, that became Agnes in Saskatchewan. And I'm just wondering if you can speak to the idea of how she was christened Agni, and how this ended up being very fortuitous, because when she was captured by the Nazis, if they thought you were Jewish, that was essentially a death sentence.
Yeah, I mean, really, this is actually, Judy, in the opening chapters of the book, when I start to lay out the child story, not my life as a child, but my mother's life as a child growing up, or being born into this new country, the world's first communist country called the USSR or the Soviet Union. You know, because this new country was an atheist country, it would be an atheist country. There would be no God in Lenin's country. But the main character, still Rosa at that time, still had a grandmother who was a staunch believer in the Russian Orthodox Church, and she became the first heroine in the book because she kidnaps this little baby within the 40-day period after birth in order to get her into the cathedral to be properly anointed and baptized with the second name, the Christian name. The Christian name, in Russian pronounced Agnia, this became the name that saved her life during the Second World War. There's no doubt about it. She was born with a name that sounded so Jewish that she was mistaken as a Jew so many times. But the fact that she could say, wait a minute, my name is Agni, this was a name that was a Christian and also sounded a little bit Germanic. Mm-hmm. But that saved her life. At the point that she was captured, it made all the difference.
Wow. And the third identity, of course, is mom. She's mom to you.
Yeah.
So she had these three different things happening. Can you discuss the title of the book, why you settled on, if it ever had any other titles, The Traitor's Daughter? Exactly to whom do you think your mother was traitorous of? And who was it that your mother betrayed?
Right. That's a great question, Judy. The title of the book has many layers. The first question is not who is the traitor's daughter, but who is the traitor? That character changes face as the book goes through its chronology.
Right.
So the first traitor is the father of the little girl who cheats on the mother. This creates so much dissonance in the family home that the little girl can't stand being at home. It was actually a journalist friend who suggested the title, The Traitor's Daughter. The first reference is simply this: any Russian woman or man who served in the Red Army, who got captured by the Nazis and survived, was perceived to be a traitor. To be captured was to allow yourself to be captured in the eyes of Stalin. That made you a traitor. So at the end of the war, these prisoners of war, they want to go home. They want to see their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, sisters, who survived. And then they discovered, oh my God, Stalin has dispatched these agents. They were called Smerch, which is a short for death to spies. These secret agents were to round up all of the former prisoners of war, all the former slave laborers, and force them back to Russia to face the music. So my mother was one of those, and she was perceived to be a traitor. So that is the original idea of the book. But to understand how that the nuances, the understanding of a traitor changes after that point in history, my mother was the traitor's daughter. I was also the traitor's daughter. But in the end, at the last chapter of the book, when my mother, after a 50-year absence from Russia, decides to go back, she discovers the truth about what happened to her own mother. And at that point, the meaning of the title of the book changes, because now we realize for the first time that the real traitor was Russia.
Right.
So it was Russia who betrayed my mother. It was Russia who betrayed my Russian grandmother. And I would argue today, because this book now is illegal and I can't go back to Russia, and my relatives will never read this book under Putin's Russia, I would say that now that I am now considered to be a traitor as well. So it's got a lot there's a lot of different nuances to the title of the book.
There's so much to this book. I mean, what your mother endured, even the three husbands, all beginning, you mentioned this with your grandfather who cheated on her mother and left the family. Then your mother had three husbands of her own. The first one was Sava, I believe he was Muslim. He was abusive to her. Then this wonderful Canadian soldier, Jack Fail, who it seemed was one of the loves of your mother's life, who brought her to Canada. He died tragically at 27. And finally, your father, another Canadian soldier, Eric Spicer, who seems to have been a very kind man. And I love that opening line of your book: Dad tucked me in and then brought his face close to give me butterfly kisses with his eyelashes. Can you speak to the effect these men had on your mom and by extension on you? We're going to hear all about that when we come back after this short commercial break. We'll be right back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
We are back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio. Before the break, I asked you, Roxana, about your mother Agnes's three marriages. Before we hear about that, I want to give a shout out to our esteemed segment sponsor, Ashford Cleaners. We want to thank Ashford Cleaners for sponsoring this segment of Finding Your Bliss. Ashford Cleaners is Toronto's best dry cleaner with hand-finished detailing, laundry, expert tailoring. you name it, and they'll take care of it while always going the extra mile to make sure you leave with a smile on your face. And they also offer you free pickup and delivery, so it's easy to keep your entire closet ship shape and ready to go. Thanks, Ashford.
Well, you know, first of all, to discover that there were three husbands was in itself a shock.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know that my mother had a husband in Russia. I found that out during when we finally went back to Russia in 1992 after the Soviet Union fell apart. So this was a big revelation to further discover that he was an abusive, violent man, and that it was the abuse that led to her joining the Red Army, thinking that she would have a better chance with Hitler than she would have with her own husband. This was a real revelation. But I was proud of her that she found a way out and that mm-hmm. she survived that. And then she mm-hmm. survived the war. And then she never spoke. Of course, I think out of sensitivity to my dad, you know, she didn't talk about this mysterious 26-year-old Canadian soldier that she met overseas at the end of the war. Very rarely did she reference this young man. His name was Jack File, a German-speaking soldier from the little town of Bruno, Saskatchewan, mm-hmm. who happened to be an infantryman and part of the liberation forces at the end of the war. So they met in a raspberry patch. And they started dating, and one thing led to another. And I felt such joy that my mother had experienced that kind of romance, a kind of a romance that I never really witnessed between my mom and my dad. And then, yes, it's one of those, that love story was doomed by the forces of nature in Saskatchewan, because Jack File, in trying to rescue a little girl who had slipped into the Saskatchewan River, got caught up in quicksand, of all things, and drowned more or less in front of my mother within the first year of their marriage in Saskatchewan. But this is the paradox. I mean, if that hadn't happened, then of course I wouldn't be here talking to you right now. But it was my dad. He was the quiet character. He was the emotional rock of Gibraltar. He was the one who really demonstrated what true, unwavering, unfaltering devotion and love was really all about. That no matter what was going on with my mother psychologically, he was going to be there for her. He was the most loving man you could ever have ever met. And he was a fantastic role model, I think, for my brothers. Just a really good, decent, kind, gentle force in all of our lives. Yeah. So he really provided that kind of emotional stability when my mother was suffering what can only be described as, understood now in today's lingo, as PTSD.
Post-traumatic stress disorder. Absolutely.
Right. But then, of course, that acronym didn't even exist. So he was there for her.
He was the rock of Gibraltar. And there's so much that your mother went through. I mean, you write in the book about how your mom's nightmares ended when her babies were born. I think that was one of the happiest things in her life, to have these three children, yep. You and your brother, the twins, you and Victor, and your other brothers, the three of you. But there was one trauma that she endured that I really found very hard to read about, being beaten and locked in a box for 3 days, which, as you write, left her extremely claustrophobic, and that she could barely go in an elevator for years after that. And I just wondered, like, where did her strength come from? Like, that story alone.
Yeah.
How did she survive that? Being locked in a small box for 3 days.
Right. No, we talked earlier in sort of general terms, we hinted on about this question, you know, how did she survive? And of course, this is the question that runs through the whole book.
Yes.
On a very surface level, she survived the camps because she was able to speak German and she became a translator. Perhaps her ability to defend herself in a physical way, because she was an expert with the use of a knife. Her hands, her best friend described her hands as mortal weapons. That's the kind of description that would make anybody stand up, sit up and pay attention to, hey, mom, what's that all about? And I just want to say one example, you know, when you're a little kid and the rumor around town, we're talking about a village of 80 people, is that your mother could take a handful of kitchen knives, throw them across the room and form a perfect pattern around a frying pan that happened to be hanging on the wall. It makes you wonder, wow, Mom, where did you learn that? Yeah. But I want to come back to your central question, which is, what is the answer to the how did she survive? And I have to say, the reason I believe that she survived everything is love. Yes. I know it sounds a little bit Pollyanna, maybe a little cliche, but there's a reason why things are cliche. Yeah. And I believe, and she said it in her own words, you know, when she finally met her sister after a 50-year absence, she said to her sister, "Your love saved me from a bullet." Yes. She also told me in an interview at some point that it was her unfaltering belief that one day that she would be free of the capture, that the war would end, that she would be reunited with her mother, with her sister, her brother, that she would once again step foot in her homeland. And because she always had faith, and the belief that she would do that, it was the love of her sister, the love of her family, the love of her homeland that got her through the war. And ultimately, I don't think she ever really lost the hope that she would one day go back to Russia, even though certainly during the Cold War, that was just an impossible dream. I mean, the Iron Curtain was a real thing. You know, we're three generations away from it, but, you know, our little town, our little village, within a 50-mile radius, there were six underground bomb shelters against the so-called Soviet red threat, including under the in the basement of the local police station I discovered very recently. So this was a real thing, the Cold War, but she never lost the faith that someday she would go home. And Judy, it was only because of the fall of the Soviet Union that really enabled that to happen. Yeah. And I'm glad I had a camera to shoot that.
Well, that scene of them being on the railway tracks 50 years later, her and her sister, Nella, and then you got to meet all her daughters, your cousins, but her and Nella standing there after 50 years, hugging for 4 minutes, 5 minutes, the hug that would never end, that hug that went on forever. That was very filmic to me, by the way, when I read about that. And this was included, this reunion, in your short film, Strangers in Graveyards, which documents your mother's first trip home to Russia in 50 years, captures the moment when your mom and Nella reunited at Chusovoy train station and the 20 days that they spent together. Like, my God, what a gift that you provided for. Can we roll that clip?
It took 50 years to erase the past and 20 days to bring it back. Strangers in Graveyards, my mother's story.
I could smell Russia as soon as I got there. And all of a sudden, like I never been away. That when the reality set in.
Half a century later, reunited. A lost sister found.
Oh my God. You're speechless because I can't imagine what that reunion was like for those two sisters. And you got to see this.
Yeah, Judy, you know, you asked me earlier about this conflict between daughter and journalist. And just put yourself in my shoes for a moment. You know, that train is coming into the Chusovoy train station. It's a classically a misty, foggy afternoon. I had to make a decision. I mean, I had to make a decision. The wheels are starting to slow down. My mother's going to get off the train. We're going to get the baggage together. Something really incredible is about to happen. And I had to make a choice. Was I going to be the daughter participating in this reunion, or was I going to be the journalist stepping back and filming it? I mean, that was a real moment for me. And I asked Mom, I said, "Mom, can I film this?" And she said, yes, you can. So what happened was we got off what you can't see on camera, but what's happening behind the scenes. I stepped physically away from my mother, which was really hard to do physically, I'm standing some distance from her. I framed her in the viewfinder. I saw her sister appearing over her shoulder before she did. I prayed to God. I said, please, film gods, keep the camera steady. Like, because I was just shaking, just vibrating. And I said, oh, I just got to stand still. Wow. And that again is what I did. I just stood there and I just let the scene play out in front of me. Judy, they didn't even notice me. I was like a lamppost on that railway platform. And this magic happened in front of the camera. And I get to relive that, which is truly probably the highlight of my journalistic career, that 4.5 minute piece or 4.5 minutes on the platform. And I'm so glad that I just trusted my instincts to step back, be silent, stand still, trust that everything is going to unfold the way it should. And then this magic, and isn't it interesting, those two women, those two sisters who hadn't physically seen each other for 50 years, who last saw each other on the same railway platform when they were teenagers, that they could not speak for 4.5 minutes.
Well, and 100%, the silence, the hug, and then you play this beautiful music. And I wanted to know in that first song what some of the words meant.
I'm glad you asked me about the music. That music is an actual recording of my mother's sister singing.
Wow.
And she's singing about the snow falling, the first snowfall, Sniegupat, you know, the snow is coming down. And it was one of the great classic ballads from my mother's childhood. So music became a very bonding kind of medium, where language, certainly for me, not really having a grip on the Russian language, the music was saying sometimes much more than the words could.
Mm-hmm. The music was powerful. The silence was also powerful. You talk about how everyone would sit before a journey and no one would talk. It's a little bit of a superstition, yes?
Yeah, and it's really, really powerful. And I, you know, honestly, I still do it. The Russian tradition is, before you are about to embark on a long journey, there's always that, you know, excitement and chaos and all the last minute packing and all the rest. And then the taxi's coming or someone, you know, getting ready to jump in the car or whatever. But the idea is you assemble and you sit together quietly, and you just be together in that moment, and you're united in that moment. So yeah, that was another powerful example of silence more binding than conversation by times. And yeah, no, that is one of those Russian things.
If this becomes a film, I want to see this scene, which is at the end of the war, when your mother was smuggled into the Netherlands by this Canadian soldier, Jack Vale, who she would go on to marry. And you write, so Jack's army chaplain got a uniform and soldier's book. He dressed me up as a soldier, a Canadian soldier,
right,
to get me across from Germany into Holland. Everything was so big, you know, like I was feeling like a clown, for Christ's sakes. There were three in front and they put me in between two soldiers in the back of the Jeep in the back seat. He just told me, keep your head down and don't show your hands. And we just went to the Canadian Army thing where they were installed. We went through Oldenburg. They let us right through. They just saw that the Jeep was Canadian, so they didn't give us any trouble. Yeah, that's why I got here. But even just that scene of her wearing this huge Canadian men's uniform.
Right. You know, actually, I think, you know, that's one of the most romantic scenes in the book.
Yeah.
And one of the most courageous scenes in the book. I mean, let's remember again, you know, this guy, Jack File, he was a 26-year-old farm boy from Saskatchewan, and he cooked up this plan with the help of an unidentified Edmonton chaplain, the army chaplain, to smuggle my mother out of Germany into Holland. And why did she have to be smuggled out of Germany into Holland? Because the danger at the end of the war was not the Nazis, but now the Russians, these secret agents, 23,000 secret agents dispatched across Europe, like a huge dragnet, to force these people back to Russia, whether they wanted to go back or not.
I want to tell the future readers of The Traitor's Daughter that there are also many kindnesses that were displayed.
Absolutely.
So amidst all the horror, and one of them, and there's so many, and we've listed a bunch of them, and you'll have to read the book to hear what some of them were. But when your mother's second husband, Jack, drowned at age 27 after the funeral, a classmate of Jack's offered your mother a job at the Netherhill Hotel. At the time, your mother had never cooked an egg in her life, but she became a phenomenal cook, and she developed this passion for cooking, and she owned and operated Agnes's Dinette and then the Homesteader Restaurant years later. I thought that's so fascinating. And you described the food she served in Agnes's Dinette. Folks drove for miles for mom's prime ribs served with potatoes whipped in butter and garden peas and dill that didn't come from a spice tin, or her thick roast gravy sandwiches swimming in gravy for $1.35. And you also describe her cooking traditional Russian dishes such as pelmeni and borscht. Do you think she found this was one of her blisses, if you will, comfort in cooking? And have you inherited this from her?
Oh, you bet. I think that, you know, food, like music, is an instant shortcut to culture, family, companionship, comradeship. And the food that my mother cooked, she loved feeding people. To be able to bring people together around a table, this is a setting in which wonderful conversation played out, in which, you know, family celebrations. And it's a connection between the past and the present. Because even today, I can't eat one of those Russian-style dumplings, which are called pelmeni, without instantly being transported into my mother's kitchen. And I have a number of Russian friends in Toronto, and I would say Ukrainians as well, who share in this love of this particular kind of food. So yes, absolutely. This is a wonderful thing to be able to feed people and to come together over a meal that evokes the culture and the language and all that goes with that.
And also a remembrance of your mother. It's like another way to stay connected to your mother. I mean, obviously this book is a huge way, but through food, which is just a sensory, beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It must have been incredible for you to go back to the very beginning last year to the book launch in Netherhill, Saskatchewan, that, as we talked about in its prime, had a population of 80 people. You said it was so packed, it was the only time you've ever seen a traffic jam in your town. It must have been such a full circle moment. How did that land for you, getting that kind of reaction when you did your book launch back in the place where it all began for you?
Oh my God, it was... Look, I've had a lot of pretty glamorous and glitzy festival celebrations over the years at film festivals, and certainly we had a wonderful launch in Toronto with literary agents, and I was so pleased that my editor, publisher, and mentors were there. It was my agent was there. It was incredible. But to physically take the book, this book, The Traitor's Daughter, to hold it in my hand, first of all, and to make a pilgrimage to the roadside graveside where my mother and my dad are buried outside of Netherhill, Saskatchewan, to hold the book and to kind of kneel at their gravesite and say, Mom, I brought your story back. We're back to the home. This is the Canadian home. That was the first pit stop, if you will. Then we got in the car with my two best friends from Netherhill, Saskatchewan, Valerie and Linda. And we drove down Highway Number 7, which hasn't changed one bit since the 1960s, as far as I can tell. Drove off the gravel road, coming down the road. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. The community hall on the left-hand side of the road, this is a town that has four blocks. The main street has four blocks. There were pickup trucks, motorcycle, camper trailers. There were cars. There were about 40 different vehicles parked in the wheat fields beside the community hall. And so that's what I'm referring to, the first time I ever saw a traffic jam. And then I walked into the community hall.
Wow.
The little community hall that has been so lovingly and beautifully restored by one of the local ranchers, Lionel Story, who happens to be the best friend of my brother, Harold. He still lives there. He organized a work crew. They went into that abandoned building. They cleaned it out of all the pigeon droppings and the nests and everything. They scrubbed the floors. They rented a generator for so-called fairy lights. They borrowed some white tablecloths. They brought tables from a wedding. They filled that community hall. This is the community hall in which my mother and father used to dance on Saturday nights. Ugh. And people came from all across the country to be part of this reunion of the past and the present and celebration of the launch of The Traitor's Daughter, this book, which obviously the main character very much still beloved for generations after the war and a generation after she passed away. So, Judy, I walked into the hall. You know, I could smell the sanded floors, fresh paint. The local women had baked a humongous cake. And on the cover, they had done a decorative representation of the cover of the book, which is my mother's face. And then, of course, I had an opportunity to do some readings from the book. The community came together. I had people come up to me and say, I haven't stepped foot in Netherhill, Saskatchewan in 60 years. So it was such a wonderful, life-affirming, exuberant experience. I'm never going to forget that. And I'm just so very proud and pleased that The Traitor's Daughter came home to Netherhill, Saskatchewan. You know, that Google calls Netherhill a ghost town.
Yes.
All right. Okay. So there are only 10 people who still live in Netherhill, Saskatchewan. But it was though all the ghosts of the past came to life for one afternoon.
Ugh.
All united under the freshly painted ceiling and within the walls of the community hall where our parents and some of our grandparents met and danced and used to have their Saturday nights in that little village. So, yeah, it was incredibly meaningful.
What is bliss for Roxana Spicer?
Oh, I have to say that the publication of the book, the memorializing of my mother's life story this was my childhood dream from the age of 10 when I first took pen to paper for the first time. That was really capping off the truly unforgettable and blissful knowledge that my quest to discover the truth about my mother and therefore the truth about myself led to the reunification of two families that were separated by war, were separated by the Iron Curtain, and today are still, once again, separated by Putin's war in Ukraine, but only in a physical sense. But spiritually, we have kept the connection between the Russian family and the Canadian family. Wow. All of that is encapsulated for me every single time that I look at the cover of the book, and the cover of the book representing, obviously, this is a photograph of my mother at the age of 23 in the first months after being liberated at the end of the war, a photograph that her sister gifted to me on my last trip to Russia.
Yes.
So I feel like I've done it. Like I did the thing that I promised my mother I would do. I wrote a book about her. The fact that Canada has embraced this book by virtue of the fact it became an instant national bestseller and stayed on the bestsellers list, that it is a lively topic of discussion now in the, you know, in the broadcast world, whether it's going to take the form of a documentary or perhaps the more ambitious plan to actually see it on the big silver screen. This story will continue to live on, and I hope continue to inspire, particularly, as I said, young women. And I would say for anyone who's out there listening to this, if you have a dream, stick with it. Just stick with it. It will happen. You just, you know, it really, if you believe in yourself and you believe in what you're doing, I mean, it worked for me. So I hope it works for everyone who's listening.
I want to thank you very much, Roxana Spicer. You're a brilliant talent, but you're also a lovely person.
Oh, thank you, Judy. And right back at you.
You can find Roxana on Facebook at Roxana Spicer or on Instagram at The Traitor's Daughter. You can also purchase The Traitor's Daughter anywhere books are sold in Canada. And some exciting news, the paperback version is now available in stores. You can also listen to the audiobook, which features wonderful narration by Roxana herself on Audible or wherever you listen to audiobooks. Each week, we spotlight a fabulous person like Roxana who is living their bliss. So if you're an author, artist, yoga, meditation, or mindfulness expert, or really anyone who has found and is following their bliss, we'd love to hear from you. We also love to feature singer-songwriters on this show, so if you're a singer, please reach out to us. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. A big thank you again to our wonderful guest, Roxana Spicer, and thanks to our Finding Your Bliss team and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center, and to our segment sponsor, Ashford Cleaners. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.